a principle that I've learned is that you've got to add value to people first. You got to give to them first, essentially. If you're wanting to start getting gigs, if you're, you know, essentially just wanting to start making money as a musician. Now, when you give, though, you know, you can't give if you've got zero to give. So if I had just quit my teaching job, had, you know, no other stream of cash coming in, yeah, I couldn't just be walking around telling everybody, yeah, I'll play for free or, you know, things like that. That's just, I don't have anything to give. But because I had spent that first year of teaching, getting rid of all my debt, building up a surplus of cash, building up, you know, various savings accounts, starting to invest, things like that. Like I had that wiggle room where, okay, now I can just start, yeah, telling people, yeah, I'll play for free and then we'll talk from there. Or I could start investing in advertisements, and, you know, investing in equipment, all of that stuff without it being, you know, really unsafe for me or that risky for me. And then I just, you know, kind of took that method and started playing at several other restaurants and doing special events and putting on concerts in libraries and art galleries and things like that. And, you know, it's just kind of like after I built up enough cash coming in per month for that, I was like, well, I can step away from my teaching job now and pursue this full time.
This is the Angles of Latitude podcast, session number 107 with classical musician, teacher, and entrepreneur, Edmund Culver.
This is squadron leader confirming hostiles inbound. Prepare for battle.
What you're about to hear is the integration of life.
Clarity is power.
If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.
Liberty.
We choose to go to the moon.
It's happening.
And all things geek.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know how to answer that.
You got a badass over here.
Welcome to the Angles of Latitude podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the AOL podcast. I'm your host, JC Preston, founder of New Inceptions, a website dedicated in helping people find their own personal freedom. Of course, this is the show where we bring you life lessons or a message from successful entrepreneurs, experts, and artists to help you do your life's work and live a lifestyle that you're proud of. Hope you're having an awesome October. Hard to believe it's my birthday month already. Really crazy how time flies, and 2017 has been a huge example of time flying, at least for me. I mean, it's just blown right by. Anyhow, things are going well with the Junto. I believe we're going to get up to 80 members this week. And yes, we've only been around a couple of weeks, so that's a vast improvement. So I hope to see you over there. And, you know, we seem to be getting some really good traction. We did our first show at Collaborate 317 last week, where we talked about why, what, and how when it comes to starting a business. And, you know, I could also say that this is, you know, how you find your passion, your purpose, and your process, and as David Anderson calls it, your mission. So that's kind of what we talked about in last week's show. Hopefully this week's show goes on time and goes on topic a little bit more so than last week. But you can check out the Junto by visiting newinceptions.com/thejunto or simply doing a search for the Junto on Facebook. Speaking of missions, today's guest is definitely someone who is on one, and through his music, Edmund Culver reaches out to those who are going through tough times, and you'll hear that he helps folks realize that they're not alone in the issues that they might be going through, but he does this in a way that you might not expect. For one, he's a classically trained guitarist, and two, he wants to inspire others to find their own truth. So what does this have to do with business and freedom, you might be wondering? Well, actually quite a lot, as you'll find out. But let's just say that, you know, he's been able to find his own freedom by finding his own truth. So in today's session, I learned from him how he made the transition from teacher to performing artist, why he applied for a leadership internship this past summer with Wall Builders in the Blaze Studios, how that experience has been able to help him make more significant work, and a few things people should consider when pursuing a career in music. So this session is powered by Facebook groups for entrepreneurs. And as you've heard, my new group, the Junto, is growing fairly well. We've had some good engagement, and I'm excited to see what the group becomes. But the question is, you might be wondering, why did I start making a Facebook group? Well, the truth is that I've realized how a lot of people consume their content these days. And it's through social media. No longer are people, surfing the web, they're browsing Facebook or whatever social media platform is their big go-to one. And Facebook, obviously being the largest one out there, seems like the place to get involved with. So instead of combating Facebook, making a group allows me to join in on all the content that's being flowed in there. And now, the thing is that there are specific ways to grow a group, especially for business purposes. And the truth is that it's not as simple as you'd think. You have to know how to engage, entertain, and position yourself within your group. You also have to know how to set up your group and your profile, your own personal profile, so that people can easily find it. All of this and more is covered in Arnie Giske's Facebook Groups for Entrepreneurs course. Arnie himself has 30,000 plus people in his own group, and so obviously he knows what he's doing. If you want to check out the goods before you get the course yourself, I have a couple of links for you. The first is for his free cheat sheet, which, let me tell you, has honestly a lot of value. Really, a lot of the little tricks and things that you can do with your profile is in there, as well as ways of bringing people into your group. Not everything is in there, but a lot is. You can find that by going to newinceptions.com/Arnie Cheat Sheet. And the other freebie that we have available for you is actually training that he did in a webinar, and you can get access to it. If webinars are more your thing than cheat sheets, by going to newinceptions.com/Arnie Group Webinar. One more thing about this is that if you act this weekend, all right, today is, what is today? Today, as I'm recording this, is Wednesday, October 11th. If you act this weekend coming up, you'll actually be able to get a few bonuses because of a birthday special he's doing. His birthday is Saturday, and because of that, he's doing a 48-hour deal where he's adding special bonuses, and this is the cool part, he's going to be donating a chunk of revenue to charity. How cool is that? So yeah, now is a really great time for you guys to get started in your own groups. And again, those two links are newinceptions.com/Arnie Cheat Sheet and newinceptions.com/Arnie Group Webinar. And Arnie, just in case you were wondering, is spelled A-R-N-E. Okay, so that all being said, gang, let's get on with today's session with Edwin Culver. Show notes and show note extras can be found at newinceptions.com/107. And of course, I'll be on after the show to fill you in on anything we might have missed. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. JC here, and thanks for joining me today. A lot of things on my mind. This is actually still the week of Hurricane Harvey, and hopefully, things are going well down there again. Co-host Layla Ramadian, family is down there, and I haven't quite talked to her this past week because I know that she's quite busy with them, at least according to Facebook, and hope that everything is going well down there. But that being said, one of the things that I'm finding out as I'm going through many interviews that I've had on the show, and really just, my journey of meeting various entrepreneurs, artists, and the creatives in general, is that with success comes a natural leader position. And John Maxwell, he says that influence is leadership and leadership is influence. With, influence comes a natural leader position. And, you know, one prime example is maybe how a lot of people would say that Donald Trump came into the office, and even how, you know, people like Kanye West and others, you know, including The Rock and Tom Hanks, you know, talking about becoming the next president. And, you know, that's all well and great. I mean, everybody, you know, likes those individuals, or at least, you know, substantial amount of the population likes those individuals. And they're thinking, oh, yeah, this will be a great idea. But the question is, you know, are these guys any better situated to lead the free world? And if they're not, why not? And I think the main thing is that they, and let's face it, a ton of folks probably don't know the idiosyncrasies of what makes the U.S. great, and, you know, that what the country actually stands for and all the history that goes behind it is kind of a big deal. And when we're talking about, you know, starting businesses and being able to pursue what we want to in life, because without those freedoms, then we wouldn't have the basic ability to go after that stuff. And so, you know, I think that to be truly great, you know, people need to understand their history so that they don't, you know, for one, repeat the mistakes in the future. But, you know, there's other reasons as well, as just to know the rules of the game, so to speak. I had a post about this a long time ago, that if you understand government and how your country works, then you understand the full bounds, as it were, of the game that you're playing, of developing your own personal freedom. And that aside, people that don't know those rules, how do you actually, you know, reach those that, you know, maybe they have no interest in learning about history, and, you know, maybe they don't even have the time. I know that a lot of people are on social media these days, so you're always getting notified of one new thing, and it's just kind of crazy. So today's guest is actually someone that's hopefully going to be able to answer some of these questions. And he's a classical guitarist, composer, and music teacher who, you know, moved to Sarasota, Florida after earning a music degree at Hillsdale College. And, you know, he taught K through 12 music history and theory for 2 years, and then decided to take the plunge by quitting the 8-to-5 job and pursuing a full-time performance career. And he also has been working to publish music curriculum that teaches young people how to discern and love what is truly beautiful in the fine arts. And his name is Edwin Culver, or known as Edwin Jordan Culver. And welcome to the show today, Edwin. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going, JC?
Great, great. Catching me in the middle of a swig there.
Sorry,
but yeah, no, totally pleasure having you on. And, you know, I had really been interested in some of the stuff that you had been talking to me on Facebook about, and that I think that we connect on a lot of different levels and a lot of different topics and relations to, okay, once someone becomes a creator, okay, and they've gotten past that whole 9-to-5 thing, then what? What if they get the all the influence and all the income and all the great cars and all the trinkets, if you will, of being successful? Then what? And it seems, again, looking at what I was just talking about there in the monologue, is that a lot of those people have aspirations to change the world. And how do you change the world? Well, a lot of people believe that it's government. So I'm sure we're going to kind of get into that. But before we do, answer this question. How does a teacher turn into a musician? Had you already had previous a background in music? Or I guess you did, because you're a music teacher. But how did you go from teaching music theory to becoming an actual full-out musician?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, first off, just thank you for having me on the program. It's actually the first time I've ever been on a podcast, so it's super exciting. And actually, to answer your question, over the last 2 years, a lot of things have been the first time I've done them. So I kind of faked my way as a musician. That's why I was a music teacher at first, because I was simply not good enough yet, or at least not confident enough in my own abilities and my own technique to be a full-time performer. And so what's kind of interesting is in college, I earned a bachelor's degree in music performance. And I was playing the classical guitar okay for my level. But of course, I was looking at a lot of guys online and that sort of thing and just knew, man, these guys are in a totally different league than I am. But at the same time, at the same time that I was learning how to perform this instrument, I was also just reading about music and music history and music theory with every spare second I had. I remember, I think it was my sophomore year of college. It was kind of like the iPhone 2 or something. One of the new iPhones had just come out. And so they were a lot cheaper, and my family happened to be able to get, you know, a few through my father's business plan. So now I had this iPhone, and it was the first time that I had internet and, like, could download PDF files and stuff onto my phone and have them with me all the time. So I remember I'd be standing in line, waiting in the cafeteria, reading, you know, this really crazy music theory about 20th century composers using these really big words and stuff. And I was just eating the stuff up, could not get enough of it. And so this kind of led to an interesting problem where by the time I graduated, I had a ton of head knowledge.
Yeah, I can relate. Yeah, for sure.
And so, but I knew that, like, my fingers, actually taking that head knowledge and applying it through my fingers on the instrument was just going to take even more years of drilling and practicing. So, you know, how did I become a music teacher? Well, originally I thought, well, I'm just going to go and get a graduate degree, get a doctorate degree, that sort of thing, in classical guitar and keep working on my performance stuff. But I also really, this was my senior year of college, so I really loved just talking about this music and explaining it to people because I discovered that it's a lot easier to understand once you take the time to just kind of pick it apart piece by piece. And suddenly, when you do understand it, it's so meaningful to understand it. So my friend at college wanted me to give this lecture on a composer called Schoenberg. Really kind of a heady guy, really intellectual and that sort of thing. And I gave this lecture, and a couple, a principal and his wife from a school, a K through 12 school that was about to open up, were visiting at the college, and they heard that lecture and immediately came walking up to me and said, "We really enjoyed that. Would you like, would you be interested in teaching music at our school? We don't have a music curriculum at all. And so you would have full range over how you developed that." And, nice. You know, so it was really kind of this crazy, like, well, that wasn't in my plans at all whatsoever. Let me think about it. And so sure enough, over the next couple months, I did a couple things. I went out to Arizona and took a few master classes with those classical guitarists that I've been watching on YouTube and stuff. And when I got there in their presence, man, did I ever know they were out of my league.
Well, and you know, it's funny that you bring that up because, you know, back in session 56, I had Dane Maxwell on. You know, you've probably heard it, but in that conversation, you know, he was talking about how, here he is, you know, he'd been playing music up until a point, and I don't know if it was in the conversation, but his story goes like this. He was playing music up until a point, but he was kind of like outcasted as being kind of a weirdo and whatnot. And so when he got to college, and it was a weirdo because of his well groomed upbringing, so to speak. And so, you know, music was a release for him. And then he eventually found entrepreneurship, you know, built his 16 companies that are bringing him passive income. And then he goes back into music. And so, you know, the thing there is, okay, he now has the music to get that education that you're talking about. And there is a big difference between saying, oh yeah, classically trained and going up through the ranks, so to speak, versus, you know, having the money that talks, or at least getting connected to those classical type people that you're talking about, that have all that knowledge to bring you up to speed so you can actually survive in the bigger industry, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And I mean, kind of along that too, though, if like all the money in the world won't, you know, that might establish some sort of relationship with these people. But once they see you play, if you don't have a certain baseline of proficiency, your history.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that too, for sure. But yeah, so you got the, you had this opportunity to become this teacher, and then eventually you got with these folks that were able to teach you more. When did you decide that it was finally, okay, 2 years of teaching, time to, you know, start my own thing?
There were a bunch of different reasons. I guess kind of maybe I'll talk a little bit about while I was teaching, the kind of guiding principle I realized ought to be leading me as a musician and as a teacher, was that I just want to share with people how to understand, appreciate, and then the next step, enjoy beautiful things. And so that was kind of like the first day of school. I remember I was nervous, more nervous than I've ever been in my whole life, because I didn't get a degree in teaching. I didn't take any sort of formal training in teaching. I remember the moment these students walked in, like suddenly that nervousness passed, and I just knew, like my heart was just, I want you to love this, this beautiful piece of music or whatever it was, you know, that I was teaching about. And as time went on and on, I started to notice, okay, some of these students, you know, they don't care about classical music at all. All they want to listen to is Kanye West and stuff like that. right. And so now my heart started breaking, because interestingly enough, I was in the same position years and years ago back. I had been this heavy metal head in high school, and nobody had ever told me anything about classical music or anything like that. And so I wanted to show them, hey, look, there's this whole other side to music that is honestly even more fulfilling to listen to once you put the time and effort and work into understanding it. So after 2 years of doing that, I had folders just brimming with ideas. And I mean, a lot of ideas I took, you know, from various music teachers or resources I was watching, listening to, reading, you know, the night before 2 a.m. while I was preparing a lesson plan. And so I had just piles of this stuff, but it's kind of all out of order. And I realized that the most magical moment was when I could organize the lesson to where I kind of built things up, and you just have this aha moment 3/4 of the way through the 50-minute period or something like that, where it just sinks in, and suddenly the music makes so much more sense, and you're just like overwhelmed by how beautiful this is. And so I started thinking, how cool would it be if I were to organize this all the way through the timeline of music history? Because there's just moment after moment after moment where, wow, Beethoven did that, and it's meaningful because you know that Bach did XYZ almost 100 years earlier, but now Beethoven's doing XYZ squared, and it's like even cooler. So I wanted to start linking those things, but like I said, I was doing these lesson plans at like 2 a.m. because I was teaching, 10 different grade levels at once, and I needed time. I needed time, and I had just paid off my student loan. I'd been performing in a few restaurants, and that was starting to take off. And I thought, you know what? I'm single, kind of living on my own right now. Might as well do the risky thing and try to become the starving artist and see what happens.
That must have been pretty exciting once you actually decided to take that plunge. How did you get, like, your, I guess you could say, your first gigs doing that? I mean, did you have anything coming into, I guess you could say, the queue as you were still a teacher, or did you just start from, you know, from bottom and work your way up, sort of thing, from right there as you said, oh, school year's over, I'm done, sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, I know. I don't know. Like, it kind of seems like I hear, and I can't think of any specific names right now, but I've heard from people like, yeah, you need to just like drop it all and take a huge risk and start from bottom. And it kind of seems like that's just sort of a mantra I've heard a lot. And that just never set well with me. So I was kind of building up little structures as I was going. When I first went into that teaching job, I told them, I was like, look, you're going to have me for about 2 to 3 years because really my dream is to be a composer and a performing musician who happens to teach. And definitely after 2 years, like everybody was identifying me as Mr. Culver, the teacher, and like no longer was I a musician. Ooh, right.
Ooh, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, I think I want to, you know, change this. The second year I was teaching, I did kind of land a steady gig at a restaurant, this Italian restaurant. It was really fancy. I'd never seen a menu that was this expensive. Just like blowing my mind that you could, you know, pay this much money for a plate of food. And, you know, I just marched into him one day and had kind of made a little demo CD. Kind of had a little sort of resume explaining that, you know, I perform sophisticated and refined sounding classical music. And like, seriously, I'd never done this really in a restaurant full time. But I just acted like I was confident, acted like I knew what I was doing, and shook his hand, you know, explained to him who I was. And immediately he said, yeah, I'm not interested. And started to turn away. He was the restaurant owner. And then I said, okay, but, how about this? You can try me for free. You just, give me dinner, and I'll perform 1 hour for free. And if your guests like it, we can talk after that. And he turned and kind of looked at me, really? And so this was kind of, you know, like a principle that I've learned is that you've got to add value to people, first. You got to give to them first, essentially. If you're wanting to start getting gigs, if you're, you know, essentially just wanting to start making money as a musician. Now, when you give, though, you know, you can't give if you've got zero to give. So if I had just quit my teaching job, had, you know, no other stream of cash coming in, yeah, I couldn't just be walking around telling everybody, yeah, I'll play for free or, you know, things like that. That's just, I don't have anything to give. But because I had spent that first year of teaching, getting rid of all my debt, building up a surplus of cash, building up, you know, various savings accounts, starting to invest, things like that, like I had that wiggle room where, okay, now I can just start, yeah, telling people, yeah, I'll play for free, and then we'll talk from there. Or I could start investing in advertisements, and, you know, investing in equipment, all of that stuff, without it being, you know, really unsafe for me or that risky for me. And then I just, you know, kind of took that method and started playing at several other restaurants and doing special events and putting on concerts in libraries and art galleries and things like that. And, you know, it's just kind of like after I built up enough cash coming in per month for that, I was like, well, I can step away from my teaching job now and pursue this full time.
Gotcha. So you're in your bio, it says that you are a composer. However, I know that you play other people's music as well. Is the performing of music of other composers fulfilling as playing your own music and whatever that you've actually made? Or, I mean, at least for me as a creative, it's like, I want to do it all.
Right. You know? Yeah. Don't we all want to do it all. So there's kind of something unique about the classical music world. And this was something I didn't know anything about until like my sophomore year of college. But it's different from the quote unquote pop music world. And I'm not trying to say that there's anything wrong with pop music or anything like that. I'm just saying that they tend to be two different disciplines. Pop musicians, what's common is a pop musician writes an album, 60 minutes worth of their own original music, and then they perform just that music, and they tour with just that music, and that's how they make a name for themselves. In classical music, it's a little bit different. You've got performers, and then you've got composers. The composers are obviously the ones writing the music, but oftentimes these guys are writing music for more instruments than they can play themselves, right? If they write a piece for a 100-person orchestra with all these different instruments and everything, there's no way that guy can play them all himself.
Right.
So yeah, so he's like, he's taking a back seat once the performance happens. And the performers then generally just play the music of other people. That's how you get paid. You look at a piece of sheet music somebody else wrote, could be a guy 400 years ago, could be a guy today. There's still a lot of classical composers writing today. It's kind of like, I don't know. I feel sometimes like a little trained monkey doing it. But it is also fulfilling, much more fulfilling than I expected, because you have a chance to investigate someone else's heart. And especially once you start doing this from music that's several hundred years old, and you learn about the historical context of that music, you learn about the political environment of that music. You learn about the personal life of that composer, and you look at that in relation to the styles of other composers at the same time, and you understand how this guy is either reacting to composers who came before him, or how he's actually going to end up inspiring composers who come after him. All of these things make this, piece of black and white paper with a bunch of dots on it really fascinating, and it's one thing to know that stuff in your mind, but then taking it to the next level and playing it for an audience and expressing it, it's like, man, history's flowing through me right now. I'm communicating a truth about something that happened. So that's incredibly fulfilling. But then, you can take that up another level too. And that's what I'm trying to do now. Which is, okay, now you compose your own music. So again, this is one thing that's kind of different from the pop world and the classical world. In the classical world, a lot of composers think about their position relative to composers who came before them, their position relative to the tradition of Western music. So a lot of the music that I write, I'll kind of borrow things and tweak it and kind of say, I found Shostakovich's music so meaningful for this reason. And so I'm using his idea, but I'm putting it in a contemporary context. That's just like taking all that stuff I described about learning a piece of older music and then working it into the world that we're all experiencing right now. I think that's just like even more exciting,
right,
to do with an audience.
Right.
But you asked me, about how fulfilling it is to perform other composers' works or my own works. And as I first started writing my own music, I actually kind of ran into a problem. I started wondering, wait, why am I doing this? And I specifically remember performing a couple of works in a concert. And afterwards, people said they liked them. And I realized in that moment that, wow, that was really empty. Like, people are complimenting me right now. They're clapping me on the back saying that was really good. And I just kind of felt like, meh, this isn't fulfilling right now. Like, and I realized in that moment, I was like, I wrote that piece for myself and it didn't really communicate to other people all that much. And it wasn't about other people or it didn't reach them. And I was like, yeah, okay, that was a problem. I need to think about this now. Why am I doing this? Why am I writing this music? And it's been kind of slow coming over the last several months, probably last 8 months. But it's just kind of funny. My whole worldview is defined by my Christian worldview. And so that has, you know, an integral part to my music making. And I started looking back into music history, looking at a lot of the other composers, and, you know, found guys like J.S. Bach or Olivier Messiaen, who, you know, they wrote this incredible music that's just breathtaking on its own terms. You don't have to be a Christian to enjoy this stuff. You don't have to be a Christian to see the logic in it or the sublime craftsmanship in it. This music just, it's like layers upon layers upon layers of meaning. Mm-hmm. And that's what I realized was, because I'd been like growing up in a lot of churches and kind of doing the contemporary worship band thing and stuff. And like, that's great for them. But there's another segment of society or culture that doesn't want something that's kind of ready-made and packaged up for you to understand on the first bite. You know, there's something that sort of gives you intellectual enjoyment when you're picking apart a difficult piece of music. So I wanted to start doing that, and I realized that these guys, the reason their music was so so deep is because they had a deep purpose for writing it, which was expressing their Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's kind of along the lines of that. There's this quote that I see all the time that, you know, Martin Luther didn't say it at all, but still, the meaning of the quote I think is important, and it kind of goes something like, it's not the job of a Christian shoemaker to make a pair of shoes with tiny crosses on it. It's his job to make a good pair of shoes. And even John Maxwell, I think you were talking about John Maxwell earlier today. I just heard him the other day for the very first time, and he was talking about like how he went from being a pastor to working in the business world full time. And he said, you know, I'm never going to bring people, like there's a whole group of people who are never going to go to church. They just don't want to. They're never going to have an interest in going to church. So I'm going to bring to them, you know, incredible business ideas. I'm going to inspire them with things that just simply help them, things that add value to their lives. Going back to that principle of, you know, you've got to add value to other people. And that's kind of what I realized too, is like, I'm looking around and there aren't too many Christians adding value to the fine arts community. There's plenty of Christians. Yeah, there's plenty of Christians making music for other Christians, and that's all fine and dandy. And they're honestly, they're way better than I would ever be at doing that. Like, go for it. But don't go for it at the expense of not making something, you know, grand and beautiful for people who aren't Christians.
Right. I you know, it's funny that you even bring that up. Actually, some of my favorite music is, it's not the worship kind of Christian alternative. I don't know what you want to actually call that, but it's more of the bands like Red or Cutlass or things like that. And, you know, I think it blows people's minds away sometimes that groups like that even exist, you know, especially if all they've ever listened to is what's on top 40 stations sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like you get over there and unlike, you know, you're going to get into your, you know, if you were to talk about Red, for example, maybe a comparative in pop culture would be like Slipknot or something, right? And
yeah, it's hard stuff.
and the thing is that it's like, unlike Slipknot, they're actually kind of pushing a positive thinking, whereas, you know, Slipknot's all about suicide and who knows what. But, you know, that's just kind of interesting to me how you can have those.
Yeah. And there's like one little thing I would add to that, too, is like when, when you're not just doing kind of the smiles and happiness style of pop contemporary music, or contemporary Christian music, that gives you the opportunity to kind of like be honest with people and like, look, there's a lot of hard things that still happen to you as a Christian.
Right.
In fact, life gets harder when you become a Christian. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but I am going to show you that there is a little ray of hope going through all of this. Again, yeah, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, like a band like Slipknot talking about suicide and everything like that. And it's like, yeah, okay, another Christian metal band can come along and talk about a lot of dark things too. But there's always a ray of hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tucked in there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Another name that I would drop is Skillet. That's a band that I've followed as well. Anyway, speaking of Christian type things, and actually how I came upon you was, I'm a big fan of Wall Builders and David Barton. And, you know, recently he's teamed up with Glenn Beck on a number of things. And one of which is this leadership program. And your mom actually called in. And she was talking about you and your brother and how you'd gone through this leadership, this course, and the different things that you had learned, and that it was very inspiring, and that you got a lot out of it. So, and I'm really curious, is what did doing this leadership course have anything to do with your music background? Because me being a John Maxwell team member, I would have gone in there to kind of add it as a part of that tool set of leadership, you know. But unfortunately, I'm 35, working on 36, and it was not open to me. So,
yeah.
And
the worst.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of curious, is like, again, why did you, here you are over in the music world, I can kind of see it, I think, but I want to hear from you. Why did you go into it, and what did you get out of it?
So that program through Glenn Beck was, put a big emphasis on history and studying primary documents, actually holding them in your hands and seeing the Christian heritage that America's founding had from the beginning. But like I said, it all revolved around history.
Right.
So what did that have to do with, you know, being a full-time music career, you know, having a music career? Absolutely nothing. but also, it also had everything to do with it, because music, it expresses profound truths about human beings that we can't express in words. And, there's so many profound things to learn about human history. If you want to know who we are as, you know, people, if you want to know what our purpose is on this earth, which these are all the sorts of questions that keep musicians up late at night, well, then you have to first start looking back in history and see how people answered that question before you. I got to give my mom credit here, because, you know, she cracks me up all the time. Like, I remember when, Glenn Beck was talking about us on his program. I was over in China. And so she was sending me all these emails saying, oh, you got to listen to the Glenn Beck program. And I was like, well, I can't access it because I'm in China right now. and it was like, even that, you know, the getting into the program in the first place, I didn't even know about the program at all. She just called me up out of the blue and said, hey, this program exists. You should apply. And without even hesitating, she got like two sentences into explaining what it was. And I was like, oh, I'm going. I want to go so badly. Because she told me that, you know, you'd be studying history and you'd be handling these primary documents. Mm-hmm. And the reason I had that desire is just, I think as a musician, I want to experience everything to the fullest that I can. Because, you know, when you experience that, then that comes back out through the music, and that you just kind of create this cycle that just kind of, you know, keeps resonating with itself. So I really want, you know, I want to know more about this country's history so that I can understand where we are today. Because a lot of the music, a lot of classical composers, honestly, have become very political lately. Not in just like the things that they're writing or the, you know, Facebook posts they're making, but in the music itself. They're composing a lot of music that, either talks about moral events like 9/11, or where they grapple with things like, should we be torturing, terrorists that we've captured in Guantanamo Bay? They generally have this negative view on what I would think people on the right would kind of say is a necessary thing to do to protect our country or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, I guess if I'm going to write a piece of music and it's going to stir somebody else's heart, I want to stir their heart in the right way. And how do I know what the right way is if I haven't studied history, if I haven't, grappled with the truth about things, if I haven't grappled with what is right morally in a given situation? And sure enough, when you start investigating history, you start overturning all sorts of things you didn't know happened. And it gives you a totally different perspective on people that, you might have had a negative view towards beforehand, or a positive view. A lot of things like when we started looking at the history of slavery and the founders, guys like George Washington, he couldn't stand owning all of these slaves, and he was trying to do everything he could to free them. But, once he married his wife, he inherited another, another couple hundred. And Thomas Jefferson, a lot of these guys were, if you look at their writings, were kind of bemoaning this the whole time, because it was the law of Virginia that they had to, they couldn't free their slaves, or if they did, they had to pay for all of their housing and everything like that. And they had just funded a Revolutionary War. They couldn't, deal with these problems on their own. What I just kind of realized is a lot of people like to look back, to the history a couple hundred years ago, and we kind of sometimes think, oh, things were so much better then. And it's like, even though we look at it and we look at the tragedies that were happening, but we're still like, but if only we were alive back then, the culture wasn't.
Well, and you got to admit, it's so much easier to look into the past with, 2020 hindsight for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Not to get onto a tangent, but yeah, we just got hit by Hurricane Harvey, but we've had 12 years of no hurricanes really touching us. And yet, suddenly, it's because of the magnitude and all the rain that came with it. The environmentalists are going, I told you, it exists, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So just I think that when people look into the past, knowing what we know now about how good or bad the situation was with slavery, but if you put yourself in actually that point in time, then how would you have actually done anything differently is the question, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that's where, as a musician, I'm most interested, is that was a difficult situation for people alive at that time. Just right. Like we have a lot of difficult situations right now, whether it's, things like, gay marriage or abortion, all of these issues that I'm not, they're difficult issues to sort through. Our foreign policy, our economics, all of these things. These are just simply difficult decisions to sort through. And I think most people, generally, when we're just talking about your everyday citizens, not so much talking about Congress right now, but your citizens, we've all got something inside of us that wants things to work out better. We want a better world. But it's difficult, knowing the best means to that. Or sometimes we just choose means without having investigated them fully. There's just a whole host of problems that just makes life difficult. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I personally like to express in my music a lot, is the difficulty of life. And now that I've looked back, not just at the era of the founders, but a lot of other people in history too, it's something that kind of gives my music weight, or like it deepens it and shows that, look, this is a problem we've faced throughout human existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you're facing this problem, you can remember other people have been there too, and they made a decision when they were faced with that problem. And they either learned from their mistakes and made the right decisions, or they didn't. And this is another moment for us to reflect on those decisions that we're making daily when we're faced with difficulty. And I'd never want to write a piece of music that has an overt political agenda to it, that, you know, sounds like it was written by someone on the right side of the aisle or written by someone on the left side of the aisle. I simply want to express the truth. You know, fine art is much more complicated than just being on the right or being on the left. And I hope that these complications would move someone to investigate the truth for themselves. That's what happened to me when I first really started to discover fine art, is it posed so many difficult questions, whether they were political questions, but even religious questions or moral questions, all of the complications that arise in those sorts of situations. I found myself hungering to find the truth, to make sense of it all. And that's how I wound up, you know, going from a music major to being a music performer and trying to do the entrepreneurial thing, but at the same time winding up in these classes taught by David Barton, sponsored by Glenn Beck, where I'm, you know, experiencing history firsthand with the primary documents. All of that happened because I was first inspired. My heart was first moved by the fine arts. And, you know, you talked about in the introduction, you know, a lot of people's hearts aren't into learning history and avoiding the mistakes of the past. But I think the fine arts provides a platform where I can inspire those sorts of people to start asking those questions, to search for the truth, not worry about a right or left, but to search for the truth.
So what about the, you know, you got a lot out of it, obviously, but were there any particular, I guess, experiences that you had during your time that really impacted your overall thinking and what you got out of it?
Yeah, like I said, there were a lot of things. Just like, I mean, there were practical things from, okay, suddenly I'm surrounded by a lot of entrepreneurially minded individuals. I got to see, you know, Glenn Beck's office and how it's just like, I mean, just, it's not cluttered, but I mean, it's just full of ideas, just brimming with ideas, and they're big ideas. And this guy has huge dreams. And not only, they're not just like personal dreams, like for himself, where he's like, I want to, you know, be successful and make money. It's nothing like that. It's like, no, I want to see change happen in the lives of other people. I want to improve them.
Yeah.
And like there, yeah, there was something underneath that though, that I still wasn't quite able to articulate. Like, why would someone have this drive for changing other people in this way? And it wasn't until, I don't know, just a couple days before the program ended, we heard one out of many stories. But this story was about the first meeting of the Continental Congress. And I remember I heard the story, and it was just kind of like a quick story that was told in passing, because it wasn't necessarily an exciting one with like war or battle or anything like that. You know, there are a few, kind of like when Samuel Whittemore was stabbed, what was it, like 12 times by a bayonet after downing three soldiers, and the guy was in his 70s and lived to be 92. After that, it's just like, oh man, like that's a that's a tough dude.
Right.
Like, then I was like, you know, I was like, okay, lesson there is, you know, anytime I feel like I'm having a bad day, just remember Samuel Whittemore. My like goodness, man, he was incredible. But this other story was just kind of, like I said, wasn't like as exciting on the surface at first. But the more I started thinking about it, I was like, whoa, that right there, that's the secret. The first meeting of the Continental Congress. All these guys get together, and you know, one of the first motions is that we should start this thing off with a prayer. And immediately the room breaks out into an uproar. The Anabaptists are standing up and saying, I'm not listening to a prayer from a Lutheran. And the Congregationalists are standing up and saying, I'm not listening to a prayer from an Episcopalian. And everybody's arguing about this.
Mm-hmm. Like they would today. More
right,
or less.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's like in that moment, almost like the founding of the country just fell apart, and you know, we never would have had anything, because this was 1774.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Samuel Adams stands up and says, you know, I've heard that there's a fellow here, Mr. Duché, who gives a really great prayer. I'd like to invite him in. And that was a big deal because basically Samuel Adams was of one denomination and Duché was of another one. And the two denominations were known for being at odds with each other. So now everybody else kind of saw the example of Samuel Adams inviting this other reverend in. Well, he shows up the first day. He gives the prayer. A bunch of guys are so moved by it. One guy writes in a letter that, oh, I was so moved by that prayer. I would have ridden 3 days just to hear it. And then the next day, rumors start coming in that the British have started sailing ships into Boston and that they are firing into the town. And so the very next day after that, so this is, I think it was like September 6th or so. Don't quote me on that. But 2 days after the first meeting, everybody gets back together and meets again. Reverend Duché comes in, and every time he would deliver a prayer, he would start by opening up the Book of Common Prayer, which had been written back like in the 1600s. And so in the Book of Common Prayer, you had all of these passages of scripture and you know, an actual prayer written out, things like that, that have already been planned for the calendar. And so he opened it up to, like I said, I think it's September 6th. He opened it up, and sure enough, what's the psalm to be read for that day? Psalm 35. So for the past 100 years, reverends have been reading Psalm 35 on this day, on this calendar day. And in that psalm, David is talking about being surrounded by his enemies who are wrongfully his enemies. You know, someone like Saul, is like, he's just kind of like, I haven't done anything to these guys, and they're all surrounding me. Lord, I need your protection. And by the time you get to the end of the psalm, he, you know, David's saying, I trust that you're going to deliver me, God. All of these founders, when they read that psalm or they heard that psalm on that day, the day that they found out they were going to war with the strongest military in the world, all of them thought this could not be a mere coincidence that we're hearing this psalm today. And that galvanized their hearts. Again, it's one of those moments like, if I don't care how much you intellectualize to someone, how many books you have them read, you're never going to get them to die for your cause if their heart is not in it. And how were the hearts of the founders stirred at the beginning of this war? By a psalm, a piece of music that was written millennia before by King David.
Wow.
So you know, that again, that was just kind of like, for me, well, okay, everything just made sense now.
Right. Wow. Obviously that story sticks out pretty well, and I can understand why, you know, you thinking about everything that Glenn has planned out and why it all makes sense and how it all clicked. Have there been any lessons that you learned from the experience that you've directly applied to your career as a musician?
Again, a lot of, like, I guess, smaller practical things, but the main thing I would say, you know, in the past year, as I've been doing this kind of steadily, is it had turned into a lot of, I guess, routine. All right, I get everything packed up, go do the gig, yada yada, get out, you know, exhausted afterwards, just want to go hang out and, you know, have fun and wake up late the next morning, do the whole musician thing. And I was starting, it wasn't so much that I was burning out, but I was actually starting to get a little lazy, because it was kind of like, okay, I'm living comfortably here. I'm making enough cash to, you know, get by. Why not just stay here? And so when I was there, hearing these guys, I didn't even see Glenn back until like a week in. He was on vacation for the first week. So I just kept seeing the paintings he had made. I kept seeing the little slogans that were written up on the walls and stuff. And I just realized, this guy is full of big ideas, not just like little sort of status quo ideas that'll pay your bills, but like big ideas that are going to stretch him, that are going to stretch other people around him, and, you know, stretch them to be better people. So like practically, I just kind of realized, man, all right, I've got to step up everything I'm doing. As a performer, honestly, like, one of the toughest part when you're a musician is marketing, because you don't want to do that. You just want to be the artist tucked away in his, you know, his studio creating.
Yes. Even as podcasters, that's how we are.
Right. And you know, on top, like there's also that sort of like humility thing. And I hate having to talk about myself or, you know, try to talk myself up and like, you know, point out to people like, this is how qualified I am and stuff like that. I'd rather just be like, just let the art, you know, speak for itself. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And that's what I realize is I've got to come up with big ideas that inspire other people too, because they can read through if I'm just marketing to them and all that I'm thinking in the back of my mind is dollar signs. If I'm marketing, you know, whether it's just like a public audience on Facebook or if it is venue owners or that sort of thing. Again, it's back to that lesson of you got to get people's hearts inspired by it. They're never going to buy my music if their hearts aren't stirred by it. And I'm not going to be able to keep making music if they're not paying my bills. So, I've got to learn how to communicate to them with these big ideas that make, you know, that inspire their hearts to want to know more.
And, you know, again, going back to what Dane has been doing with his music, I mean, the guy is constantly talking about, you know, reconnecting with people's hearts and emotions and things like that. And that's really what, you know, he's built his music around, is that, and it's because people are so cerebral about things anymore that, you know, they tend to confuse their emotions with their logic at times, I think. And it's being able to speak to the heart directly and not the mind and not confusing people that I think that what you're saying and what, you know, what he's trying to do, that's a great strategy, actually.
Oh yeah. Dane, that podcast with Dane was awesome. cool. Hugely inspirational.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, glad I was able to serve you a bit there. So you were talking about the fact that, again, you were in China briefly. Were you able to, and you were teaching English, I think it was, were you able to apply anything like do it through that? I mean, just kind of step away from the musician for a bit, teaching English. What kind of impact from your recent experience were you able to put into teaching?
Yeah. I mean, so I guess like the first thing is, back in college, I developed this love for learning anything. And so that's another reason why I've kind of wanted to become a musician, because that kind of gives you the freedom to learn about anything. And so I was coming right off the wave of going to the Glenn Beck program and having all these big ideas. And at first I was really like, oh, I don't know if I want to go to China now. I want to like sit down and implement these things and get them done. But there's still that curiosity of learning about another culture and things like that. And I went over there, and you know, it's just, you just got to go. I'm just telling everybody, you got to go to China. It's fabulous. It's fantastic. It's one of the craziest experiences you'll ever have. But the thing I learned there was, it's all about people. Because I was getting all excited about the new foods and seeing the different architecture and things like that. But the moment I stepped into that world, I was like, man, these people are incredible. And even when there were language barriers, it was fascinating to be talking with them about the same things that bring us joy over here in the States and the same things that irritate us over here in the States, or the things that irritate them over there that we take for granted over here, or things like that. And I'm not so sure I'm like answering your question, because I guess I went over there with a lot of questions and came back
with even more questions.
In one sense, yeah. With China, I keep telling everybody it's a yes and no answer, because like I came back with more questions, but I also came back with a lot of answers. But you know, the main thing I saw there, and this is, I'm trying to tie this in with the Glenn Beck program, because I think in America lately, the buzzword that we've all felt is freedom, 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 freedom. Whether you're on the right or you're on the left, it's always about freedom. And while I was in China, you know, it's very different from what, at least right now, okay, in 2017, it's very different from what I think a lot of people have been saying about China being this red communist country where, you know, you can't take a Bible over, you're going to be thrown in prison. It's kind of like, no, you can't take a case of Bibles over, but there's a Catholic church right down the road from where I was staying. Like their constitution says you can practice Christianity, no problem. You just can't be preaching it on the streets, that sort of thing.
Mm.
But as I was talking with students, as I was getting to know about their lives, what I realized is it's not about freedom. Because the people over in China have a lot more freedom than we assume they do. And there's goofy things that they don't have freedom for. But I think the founders were more interested in not just freedom for its own sake, but freedom for the sake of self-government. That's how a culture or a society is going to work. And that's what they understood. That's why they emphasized biblical learning so much, was if, you know, you can put laws in place however you want, you can come up with the perfect political system, you can have just governors and everything, but if the people themselves don't have a desire to do what is good and right, it's, you know, there's always going to be problems. And so just kind of like blanket freedom in general, that I just kind of realized, no, that's not the ideal we should all be striving towards attaining. It should be self-government. Mm. And you can do that. You don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to be, you know, a Buddhist or anything to like, achieve self-government, but those things certainly help.
Right. Right. And case in point, I mean, again, looking back at the hurricane that just happened, you know, one would say that there's a lot more self-governed people with their own guns and whatnot in Texas than maybe where Katrina happened, because there hasn't necessarily been that many breakouts of looting and all kinds of stuff, you know. But
right, 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 and that's, again, that just comes back to the old, like, it's always a choice that the individuals make, and we have to build up habits of making the right choices.
Right. Yeah. If someone was wanting to do what you wanted to do, what are some tips in making that happen in their own life?
I would say, number one, I mean, you've got to have your finances in order, and I don't mean you have to have a lot of money. I just mean you need to know how to budget, and stick to it, because especially when you're first starting, and honestly, right now even, that's why I went to China, is your business will fluctuate a lot. I'm in a spot where the seasons go all over the place, so you need to be able to look ahead towards that and think, okay, the month of August, nobody's going to be wanting to pay a musician because everybody's up north escaping the heat. You need to have your finances in order so you can survive those bumps. So that's kind of like the first thing I would say, is you have to be confident that you can do this financially.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, I hear this phrase a lot when talking with people. You know, it's kind of like it's not what you know, it's who you know. Like, it's not how good of a performer you are that will get you gigs. It's the guys you know. If you know the guy at the venue, that's how you get the good gig.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. That's never worked for me. I can't think of it, because I know lots of people who have venues, who have places that I've thought, hey, this would be a really great place to put on a classical guitar performance. But
right.
it's never happened unless...
Well, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Unless...
Unless I've, you know, done something that is valuable to them in the first place.
Well, and I was just kind of curious where you're going with that answer, because my new phrase when it comes to that particular one is, it's not what you know, it's not who knows you, or wait, it's not what you know, it's not who you know, it's who knows you and why they know you.
Yeah, yeah, and I'd say we need to really emphasize the point of why they know you. Because a lot of people, yeah, they know I'm a classical guitarist, but they just don't want to take the risk of having me in their venue or something like that. If I haven't proven to them I'm worth that risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm going with there is like, don't, because I you know, don't get caught in the sort of trap of like, okay, I networked that with that guy, passed off the business cards, we had a fun conversation, bam, you know, and you're sitting around wondering like, why aren't my gigs coming in? I'm trying to think. Any really big gig, so far, nobody's just like walked up to me and said, hey, we'd like to give you this gig. It's always been me going to them and like saying, right, hey, can I perform here at this such and such date? I'll provide this and this and this and yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm. What you're talking about right now is actually something that Russell Brunson talked about in his Expert Secrets book. And he talks about the fact that you want to start free. You want to get your name out there. You want to create a somewhat of a portfolio, but then start using it to show your results and have, you know, those recommendations. You can't just start from expecting people to hire you if they don't know what your past results are, regardless of whatever industry you're in.
Right. Yeah, totally. I'll have to look that up because that's kind of the next step too for me that I'm moving into.
Good deal. Good deal. Well,
yeah.
I'll connect you.
Russell Brunson. Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you're looking forward to right now? You're trying to get more, book more gigs and as you said, people are going to be coming back up, back down rather. All the snowbirds are going to be coming down and
yeah. Right. Yeah. So I keep telling people about this album I'm writing. That's kind of my, you know, that's sort of like my baby right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I'm about 70% done writing it. And the whole thing is, it's all planned out. So I hope to be done with that by December.
Okay.
The music curriculum, that's another big exciting thing. That's just kind of a very slow process. I'm such a perfectionist, and it's a little tough to find the motivation to put a lot of work into it, simply because I know that it's going to be a lifelong project where I'm going to keep revising it and everything like that. And that's, you know, but I have decided that this season I'm going to start kind of creating these sort of test modules where I'm just going to start uploading stuff to my social media where I give a quick little, you know, 1 to 10 minute lesson on a piece of music, analyze it, explain why it's meaningful, that sort of thing, maybe perform it. And it'll just kind of kill two birds with one stone. That's sort of my way of getting out there on the online community.
Right. Right.
But also that's, yeah, my way of kind of testing, okay, did I organize that well? How does that, you know, how do those building blocks fit together?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are the two big things.
There was actually a recent podcast that Lewis Howes was, he did with a guy that's a musician, and really interesting conversation. He talks about how to make videos viral, and he actually has a way of doing that. And he was the breakdown of it was very, very to the point, I guess you could say. And
yeah,
it's, you know, yeah, I mean, very, it was to the point, but he kind of gave you, it's like, here's how you exactly do it.
Nice.
The guy's name is Julius Dean. And apparently, right before the show, or not too long before the show, this was episode 523 of Lewis's show. He had recently just met the guy and was really pretty amazed by him. So if you're looking into making videos and want to have a way of doing it, I will say that it sounded like he did a lot of them at the beginning, and then he's only been doing like one a week since then. But maybe that if you were to look at something like what is it, Goalcast, I think is one.
Yeah.
A popular one. And you know, maybe kind of when you're thinking about what he's talking about in that episode, kind of see how, you know, they're saying, or how their videos are set up to to get the word out there on what you know, the content that they're trying to provide. So anyway, right. Yeah,
no, totally, yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Going into the rapid fire question segment here. First question is, who are three influencers or teachers that have launched you to where you're at today?
Well, you know, okay, so I can't, you know, I can't really think of anybody who like launched me into my career per se, like as a musician. Mm-hmm. I guess I look at things like in terms of principles. So my grandfather, he'd probably be the number one person, and kind of along with him, my father, because they both instilled in me that principle of toil and hard work. You know, you just put your nose down to the grindstone, and conditions are not going to be comfortable. So what? Just keep working through it. At the end of the day, go home. Maybe you can relax, maybe not, but you're doing it again tomorrow, the next day,
right.
And so on and so forth. So it's just like, yeah, just determination. And when things get hot and sweaty and dirty and gross and you're just ready to give up, you just got to keep going on, because, you know, that's how you get this stuff done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so that's how you get anything done, really. But
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 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 But again, I think, you know, you take a 10-year-old and have him mix concrete, or I don't know what we were doing, demolish buildings and, you know, putting insulation up in the ceilings and stuff, and just getting itchy and gross and nasty. Like, that makes everything else seem so much more comfortable.
Yes. I could
I was just like, I feel like a lazy bum now showing up to work and performing, and like, I'm like, wait, I'm clean afterwards? Like, this is so weird. Did I work?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the first one. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Did you want me to talk about the other influencers or?
Yeah, no. So that's the first one.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I guess another one, another big one is Johann Sebastian Bach. And he's this composer from the Baroque period. And he had this thing where whenever he'd write a piece of music in, you know, freehand, he'd sketch it out, he would always be writing down in the corner SDG, or Soli Deo Gloria, and kind of like, this is always to the glory of God. That's something I constantly have to remind myself of. But you know, it's because anytime you're performing in front of people, it's very easy for it to suddenly just kind of turn into, hey, this feels good. People are looking at me. People are enjoying me. Yeah, this is nice. But you know, there's kind of like two sides to the coin with Bach. Was he was writing this, but in privacy, like in his own notebooks, for lack of a better term, in his own manuscripts. If it wasn't an overtly religious work, it wasn't like he broadcasted once, you know, the piece was being performed, like, hey, look, I wrote this piece to the glory of God. Everybody needs to worship God along with me, or something like that. It's no, this is just something beautiful that you can, inspire and touch you as well. That was huge. Because that just kind of guides and directs, my entire musical output, I think.
What is one gift that you like giving others?
I love giving them something that I know resonates with them. I'm just thinking of times when, like, yeah, so it's not so much like there's one sort of item, or there's one sort of, I don't know, idea or thing I like teaching them. I guess just my favorite thing is when you've learned enough about the person, and you happen to be in some goofy shop or something like that, and you see something, and you're like, that is that person. Their eyes would light up as soon as I gave that to them. And sometimes that is an idea, or some sort of lesson. Sometimes that is a style of music when I'm performing. You know, I perform in a nursing home every week. Just kind of go in there for an hour in the morning, and perform for a lot of people.
And nursing homes seem to be a good place to start, or at least practice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But it's you know, like, I love performing for everybody, but there's a few people in there who have like musical backgrounds, mm-hmm. and so I can tell that it really resonates with them. And so that's my favorite moment when you like you figure out what it is that like I said resonates with that person, and you're able to give them that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the most rewarding gifts to give.
Good deal. What's the smallest decision you've made that has the largest impact on your life?
I think I don't quite remember like making this decision one day, but I remember when I first got to college and my experience in school up to that point, I don't think it had ever really stretched me that much. And in college, suddenly I was getting hit with philosophy and the humanities and all these big ideas from the Western heritage, if you will. And I just suddenly realized, man, I don't know anything like about it. I didn't know the difference between Plato and, I don't know, Plutarch or... No, I didn't know the difference between Plato and Mozart, and I was a musician. Like, come on. And so I just remember like the first day walking out of classes, like, man, I don't know anything about any of these guys. I want to go learn about them. And it was from that moment, just every spare second that I had, you know, I was reading a book about something, or I was listening to something about, you know, about a subject that I just don't know about. So it's just, I don't know, it was kind of just a small, like a little decision of, well, I want to know more about that. And from that point on, my freshman year of college, I can't get enough of learning about anything and everything.
That's awesome. Yeah, curiosity. Insatiable curiosity.
Yes, there's the word for it.
Sorry,
I'm a musician. I beat around the bush and try to explain it. I can't, you know, boil it down to a word.
What basic life skill are you constantly amazed people lack today?
Well, I guess first I'll say I'm not sure I would personally say like I'm amazed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And disappointed is kind of a harsh word too. It's just that now that I've been a teacher for a couple of years, I realize that probably a big part of the reason that person doesn't have that skill is because someone didn't take the time to teach it to them. Or, you know, they didn't teach it to them well, or they didn't inspire them to understand why that's a good thing to have. And so, you know, I don't know. For me in the music world, you know, it's probably like just basic manners and being polite and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other... Oh, yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of times I'll see other musicians on Facebook, you know, blasting someone or... making some big political statement or just using a lot of like harsh language or something like that. And I'm just kind of like, oh, dude, don't you realize like that's public now? Everybody's going to see that. And you're probably, you have no idea which customers you just turned away by acting like that.
Wow.
And it's just kind of.
Well, and I think that's part of the reason why, you know, when weather kind of come back to what we were talking about is, why you need to be open to having perspectives on both sides of a coin on any given topic or any given, you can't just be, you know, that this side is right or that side is right. It doesn't matter who's right. It's what is the truth. And once you figure that part out, then everything's easier to discuss and you're not having a hidden agenda. And, you know,
absolutely. No, right. And see, okay. See, that's another, yeah. Sorry, I'm going to go off on a real quick tangent here. I'll try to keep it as quick as possible. That was another huge thing I learned at the Glenn Beck Leadership Program, was that we can't be approaching other people by saying, well, this is what the right believes, and because it's on the right, it's right. Like, okay, we immediately turned off their ears to us. They don't want to hear anything. Or this is what the left believes, and yada, yada, yada. Like, we're immediately turning off our ears to each other. And I would rather kind of be able to walk up as a musician and say like, this is the truth. I don't care if it's left or right. I'm not going to use that kind of language because I know it's going to offend you. And honestly, if you started using the language of the left towards me, it'll probably offend me. And we'll just get at each other's throats after a few minutes. And I'd rather just present the truth and say, look, here it is. But you know, I can't just prevent the truth intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do it in a way that stirs hearts. And when our hearts are, you know, stirred by truth, then, you know, there's this internal mechanism that starts driving us to want more. And it doesn't matter anymore, like, is this on the right or is this on the left? If it's, you know, if it's been communicated or expressed correctly through the music.
Yeah, yeah. Good deal. Final one, what's the secret to achieving personal freedom?
I think it goes back to that thing I learned in China, self-government, self-discipline. Dane Maxwell said this in his podcast, didn't he? All people who are free are disciplined or something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just, again, as a musician, I'm like, oh, that's a beautiful paradox. I love it. It's like, you know, you got to have discipline and tell, you know, make rules for yourself. That this is how you're going to live your life, and then you're free. But it's true because you know you're free from all the things that we could waste time on, all of the things that just honestly are damaging towards ourselves or to others. If you've done your due diligence and built the habits of discipline, and, you know, ahead of time, when you reach a situation that is trying or testing you, you know, it could be procrastinating on your marketing. Or it could be something really, you know, just, I don't know, heinous. Right. I mean, if you've created this habit of discipline, you know, you've already made the decision. Like, no, I'm not going to do that to damage myself or to damage other people.
Good deal. Cool. All right, man. As we're parting ways today with everybody on board, if someone wants to start appreciating the beautiful in life, quote unquote, what are a few marching orders that you'd go give them as they're moving out, heading off?
Yeah. So when I use that word beautiful, you know, I kind of in class I'll use like the big uppercase letter, like beautiful. And so what I usually mean there is like the fine arts. Again, not a slam towards pop culture or pop music or anything, but it's you know, you make the comparison kind of like junk food, McDonald's food, and you know, this finely crafted Italian meal that this guy's been slaving
or even your even your Taco Bell. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah. You know, that like I think for most people, we don't start off as adventurous eaters. I used to be a super picky eater, and it's over time that you eventually start to appreciate fine dining and that sort of thing. So the same thing's true of like appreciating the beautiful in life, whether that's, you know, fine art in a museum or that's excellent classical music, reading through history, reading through primary documents. And so the first step I would say is just find something that interests you. I'm going to use the example of music, but you can apply this to anything. And that's what I did, was suddenly a piece of music by a certain composer, just like it clicked with me. I was like, hey, that's nice. So you find something you like. That's the first step. The second step, start investigating it, start pulling it apart, understand that thing from the inside or the outside. So like in the case of a piece of music, like a classical piece of music, all right, figure out who composed it, what time period did he compose it in? And then start looking at the music itself or listening to it and figure out, okay, what's the shape of this piece? Are there certain events in the beginning that come back at the end? Is there something really important that happens in the middle? And start asking, okay, why does that sound so cool? Is it because he uses a certain chord? Is it because he's developing his material some way? I know I'm starting to sound real technical and everything, but you'll start building up this kind of vocabulary.
And whatever it is, and whatever it is that you're doing,
right, yeah, right. Yeah, whatever it is you're doing, but you know, but then you can't really stop there, because like once you know that work, in of itself, for the most part, you'll never know it fully. But once you understand it, then you start looking at that guy's other pieces, All right. And you start comparing and that sort of thing. And then kind of the fourth step, okay, now you start breaking out into, okay, what were other guys of this period, creating? How was it different? How was it similar? And I don't know. What I found is when you start with something that you liked from the beginning and you start going on a quest and trying to find other pieces that have that same thing in it that you love. Like for me, I'm just going to throw out a music theory term right here, but it was the minor second interval, the dissonance. And it was like, as I started looking for that in other pieces of music, then my interest in music really expanded. And as I learned more about those other pieces of music, I started finding little things that like, oh, wow, I really love this sound. I started skipping in and out. And those sounds eventually led me to, wow, I really love it when a composer is expressing things during political turmoil. So that really, now that's where the interest in history came from. So it all just kind of starts growing and growing from there. Mm. So.
Yeah. Just mind the gap as you go along.
Right.
Yeah, it's something that I've shared numerous times on New Inceptions and in the blog and on the podcast. And there's a piece by Ira Glass that I don't know if you've heard any of the podcasts that I've mentioned it before, but definitely look that up, Ira Glass.
Yeah,
and he talks about the gap, and there's gonna be a point where you know absolutely nothing, but you know what you like, and you going along the way of recreating what you like, but in your own fashion. It's gonna be an uphill battle, but it's definitely worth it when you get to the other side. So
yeah, and I guess yeah, one last step I'd add to that is okay. Once you figure out what you like, start listening to other teachers though too. Mm. Like in the world of music, like someone like Robert Greenberg, where this guy he just knows about like every single period you could ever imagine. And when you listen to some, when you hear what somebody else likes. And you don't like it at first, that's a big flag for me now that I'm like, oh, wow, I don't like this piece right now. I bet you in exactly 1 year from now, I'm going to love this piece. that's just the pattern every time. It's like, I don't get this music at all. This makes no sense to me. Whatever. I can't stand this. But for some reason, this other guy loves it. And there's got to be a reason he loves it. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, a year later, it's like, oh, now I've got the perspective for understanding this thing, and it makes so much more sense now.
I think that's kind of like me in 70s pop rock. But.
Right. Yeah. Maybe that's me for like pop music in general.
Good deal. Well, Edwin, where can people find you if they want to know more about you and everything that you're up to?
Yeah, right now, probably the best place is facebook.com/Edwin Culver. That's where I just... I'm posting on there every single day. But edwinculver.com, that's C-U-L-V-E-R, Culver, like the burger joint. Edwinculver.com is where I'm going to start. I've been posting kind of the scores to my compositions, and there's videos uploaded on there of my performances, SoundCloud recordings, things like that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the big official thing.
Right.
But facebook.com/Edwin Culver and everything else from there. The Twitter accounts and stuff are pretty
easy.
They're all
to get to.
Yeah, you can find
okay.
them. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, total pleasure having you on, and looking forward to your future work and seeing how you're connecting with people and seeing if your efforts pay off, so to speak. So.
Yeah. Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks a bunch for reaching out to me.
Oh, no problem. Pleasure having you on, man.
Yeah. Totally. Take it easy.
Well, there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Edwin. It's really cool to see his unique spin on what he's doing and what he's aiming to do with his message. And if this story inspired you, feel free to reach out to him through social. His info, again, can be found via the show notes at newinceptions.com/107. This session's extras are a few videos from Edwin. The first two were some videos of him recently playing. The first one, I guess you could call more of a music video of him playing a piece called Chorus Number 1. I think I'm saying that right. It's Portuguese. I don't speak Portuguese. But then the follow-up to that is a recording of him doing one of his gigs. I think this might have been one that he recorded when he was still in China. After that, I have a couple of videos of him discussing dissonance or lack of harmony among musical notes. A couple of videos there. And finally, I also have a video of Edwin with his intern group showing off some of the items that they got to check out during their stay at the Blaze this past summer. So check those links out, and I think you'll get some a little bit more enjoyment if you like Edwin and his craft. Again, feel free to join us in the Junto. He's one of the founders of the group and helped me craft actually what it is at this point. And also, if you haven't heard it yet, we mentioned Dane's interview a couple of times in this chat. And so be sure to check out Session 56 for that one with Dane and co-host Daniel Postma. So that's pretty much a wrap for this particular session. Next time in Session 108, I have a fellow with a new product that I think you guys are going to probably want. His name is Andrew Kaplan, and his invention is called Success Dice. Actually, Andrew is he's an alumni of the foundation, just as I am. So the Success Dice is actually something that he put through the process. But they're a really great idea for people who have problems determining their priorities, especially in their day-to-day life. And honestly, they help the rest of us that might not necessarily believe we have big problems in our priorities. They help us by assisting us with making decisions and frankly, we don't need to be spending time on. If you think about what Steve Jobs used to do, he always would wear the same kind of clothes every day. I don't know if his closet was completely aligned with black turtlenecks and jeans, but every time that you saw him, that's what he was wearing. So, wasting energy on decisions is definitely a thing, and the success dice is something that Andrew designed to deal with that. So definitely stay tuned for that one. But yeah, guys, that's it. Remember the big 48-hour red light bonus thing with the Facebook groups, of course, with Arnie. Again, you can check it out at newinceptions.com/ArnieCheatSheet or newinceptions.com/ArnieGroupWebinar. And that said, thanks for joining myself and Edwin in this chat. Until next time, gang, dig in, have fun, and take care in whatever you're creating. And we'll see you back here next time.
Thanks for listening to the Angles of Latitude podcast. Connect with us at home, at work, or on the go at facebook.com/newinceptions, on Twitter at newinceptions, Instagram at new.inceptions, and on the web at newinceptions.com.